introduce our guests from Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection so that hopefully they will know who some of us are. I'm going to start with the Environmental Advisory Council members. Kathy?
Hi, everybody. Kathy Fay, Neighborhood Housing Services of New Haven, and I am the vice chair of this esteemed body.
Great. Laura Steen?
I was reading. Laura Steen, Environmental Advisory Committee member.
Great. Iris?
Iris Kaminsky, board member.
Great. Okay. Now we will do city administrators. Dawn?
Hi, Dawn Henning, assistant city engineer.
Great. Steve?
Hi, Stephen Winter, executive director of climate and sustainability.
Great. Jacob Robison?
Hi, Jacob Robison with the city plan department.
Okay. I think that's all the city people we have so far. All right, now we're going to start with the others, the guests. Diane Buxbaum.
Diane Buxbaum, a resident in Westville.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Tenzin Alling.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kenzum. I'm a senior at Yale, and I work with the Center for Environmental Justice, and I'm sort of here to take notes and relay back to them what you all are here to talk about.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks.
Let's see. Jeannie DiBino.
Hello. Happy to be here. I'm Jeannie DiBino. I live also in Westville and concerned about many issues, especially all the chemicals and noise and pollution that goes along with lawn maintenance.
Great. Anstris.
With the New Haven Urban Design League, we're an organization that works on planning and environmental issues.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Nancy Alderman.
Mute. I have to unmute myself. Okay. I'm Nancy Alderman. I'm president of Environment and Human Health, Inc., a nonprofit organization of 11 physicians and public health professionals. And I'm here because of the tanks that are in the harbor. And I really would like to see that they are better permitted and better taken care of, because the odors coming out of those tanks affect many of the neighborhoods that are around that area, and something really has to be done about that. And that's why I'm here. Now I will mute myself again.
Thank you. Okay. Aaron Good?
Yeah, thanks, Laura. Aaron Good. I'm with the New Haven Bioregional Group and the Greater New Haven Green Fund.
Great. Marley Antel?
Hi, I'm Marley Antel. I work as an environmental scientist with SLR Consulting in New Haven. And I also am a Westville resident and just wanted to check out the meeting, see what everyone's talking about.
Great. Welcome. I didn't quite catch the name of the company you work for.
We're SLR Consulting.
SLR?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you. And welcome. We're glad you're here. Let's see. Who else have we got? Eric Schuch?
Close. It's German. It's Schuch. Hi, I'm Eric. I'm a PhD student at Yale who studies how cities form environmental policy and a new transplant to Yale, and I'm just here to observe.
Great. Thanks for being here. Chris Ozick.
Hi, Chris Ozick, citizen of Quinnipiac Avenue. Thank you.
Great. Mary O'Leary.
Hi, I'm just here from Hearst Media.
Okay. Bruce Spearer.
Bruce Spear, newish resident of Westville, and looking to get more involved in environmental work in our city.
Great. Thank you for being here. Happy to have you. Okay. And Sally Cruz?
Yep. I'm Sally Cruz from the New Haven Port Authority.
Great. Okay. So we got everybody except the Connecticut Deep guests who have just joined us. So I will start with Jameson Sinclair.
Jameson Sinclair, Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, Director of the Bureau of Air Management's Engineering Division.
Thank you for being here. Paul Farrell.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Paul Farrell. I've sort of two roles at in the Air Bureau right now. First, I'm the Director of the Planning and Standards Division, but I've been serving in acting capacity as the Chief of the Bureau.
Well, welcome. And thank you for doing both of those, for wearing two hats for us. And let me see, Jacob Felton, I know you're driving. If you can't talk, that's okay.
Jacob Felton, Director of the Air Quality Enforcement Division with Connecticut DEP.
Great. And I think last but not least, Louis Corsino.
As a cardiologist, I put my patients on a statin to reduce cholesterol. I also tell them they can
I can hear someone, but I don't think it's Louis Corsino.
Well, I'll take care of Lou for Lou. Lou is a supervising air pollution control engineer in the Bureau of Air Management's Engineering Division. He is the supervisor for the staff person who drafted the draft Title V permits for both of the Buckeye facilities.
Great, thank you. Oh, I see
and
that.
Apparently his mic is not working.
Right, sorry, I just saw that. I apologize. Okay, great. Anybody I missed? Okay, good. So we're going to get right into our discussion about the Buckeye Waterfront and Forbes Terminals. We're discussing the Title V permit renewals. I'm going to let Jameson Sinclair tell us everything because I really am very inexpert about this. So you tell us, Jameson, you're the expert.
Sure, no problem. I have a presentation. I'm going to attempt to share my screen. Please bear with me. I'm not good at this. Okay, so I need Dawn, if you could enable sharing.
I just did.
Thank you. All right. So which do you see? Do you see Air Permit Program, Buckeye Facilities, New Haven?
Yes.
Okay, good. So I'm going to minimize that, and I'm going to work off of that. All right, so I put together a PowerPoint. My understanding is we have about an hour to discuss this whole topic. I'll probably take all of it. I apologize in advance. And there aren't many pictures in this slideshow. I apologize for that as well. The last apology I'm going to give you is some of this is going to sound technical and highly bureaucratic, and I apologize for that. But to some extent, when you look at the breadth and volume of our regulations and how things interact within the world of air quality control and management, to some extent, it is unavoidable. With that said, let's jump in. So first, I'm going to do a quick introduction of myself. I'm going to give you a history of the Title V operating permit program so you have some background on the things that we're discussing. Then I'm going to talk about Connecticut's Title V operating permit program, and in general, how to get information about a facility, regardless of whether it's in the Title V program or not, from the department so that you can participate in any activity that's going on with respect to that particular facility. Then we're going to go into a discussion of the two Buckeye facilities, the one at Waterfront Street and the one at Forbes Street. As I said earlier, my name is Jameson Sinclair. I'm the director of the engineering division. I have 26 years experience with DEEP. I started as a summer intern my senior year in college, a two-time Distinguished Service Award winner. I spent 25 years in the Bureau of Air Management, 1 year in the Office of Climate. I have a bachelor's in mechanical engineering and professional certificates in industrial hygiene and environmental health and safety from the University of New Haven. I'm a lifetime resident of Connecticut. I was born and raised in an environmental justice area, and I currently live in an environmental justice area. So my division is broken into three groups. First group is permitting. We run two permitting programs. One is the Title V operating permit program. That's what we're mainly here to discuss tonight. The other program is the new source review program. It is sort of off to the side of, but incorporated into Title V permitting for those facilities to which Title V permitting applies. I have a staff of 10 individuals who do the drafting and review of permit applications in that group. My next group is my air emissions inventory group. They're tasked primarily with maintaining an inventory of the equipment and the emissions within the state for those types of activities that are required to report their emissions to the department. So that is Title V sources and a certain subset of other air pollution sources. In addition, that group is responsible for our periodic inventory, which we put together with EPA on an every 3 year timeframe, which looks at air emissions from all activities within the state of Connecticut at the statewide level, at the county level, and at the census block level. It is a very complex process that uses a number of EPA emissions estimations models and techniques. It's a very comprehensive document. The last one we drafted was on the order of 900 pages. Finally, the other group under my control is what we call our stationary source controls group, but they are primarily responsible for drafting regulations for sources of air pollution like commercial facilities, boilers, et cetera. That group is headed by an attorney and there's two engineers in the group. The bulk of the staff that work for me are engineers. We not only do technical and design review work, but we also do regulatory interpretation and regulatory drafting. I cannot stress that, I can't stress anymore that while our desire is to make air pollution control as easy to digest as possible for the layperson, the simple fact of the matter is it often isn't, and that is because of the volume of regulations and technical information that is involved in the program. But I will do my best this evening. So a quick history of the Title V program. The genesis of the Title V program is the Clean Air Act Amendments of 1990. Its true purpose is an enforcement tool. And from that standpoint, operating permit is somewhat of a misnomer. It is really an enforcement tool. And the basic premise is it is a compilation of all the applicable requirements that are specific to the facility that you are dealing with into a single comprehensive document that enables the facility, the department, EPA, and the public to assure that that facility is operating in compliance with those requirements that it is subject to. So here's a bit of a diagram. Imagine, if you will, in 1990, if you recall, none of us had laptops, few of us had cell phones, very few of us had any type of connection to the internet. So when an inspector for either the state or the EPA went to a facility and needed to determine compliance with the bevy of applicable requirements for that facility, they literally had to leaf back and forth between state regs and federal regs. And these regs are very complicated in the fact that The reg will be specific to a certain activity, but that activity may have various permutations. And in association with all of those permutations, that reg has different compliance paths for each one of those permutations. So the Connecticut regs, when we used to give them out in paper, came in a 3-inch thick binder. And this was in the late 90s, early 2000s, okay? They've gotten thicker. However, we have the ability to share and manipulate them on the internet now, whereas we didn't back then. So the whole purpose of Title V was to make sure that those facilities that are subject to the program work with the state to compile a comprehensive one-stop shop document for the purposes of knowing what they're subject to, what they need to comply with, what records and monitoring they need to do to demonstrate that compliance for anyone who was out there evaluating compliance at the facility. The program is implemented and operated under 40 CFR Part 70. Those are federal regulations which specify what type of operating permit program Connecticut is going to operate in accordance with Title V. And when Connecticut drafted its Title V program, we had to submit it to EPA and get EPA's concurrence that it was at least as stringent as the EPA program. And why did we do a separate program over allowing EPA to operate the program? Well, one, EPA has limited staff. Two, it is better to regulate your facilities within your own state than to have EPA regulate those facilities. So it gives a measure of control to the state in terms of monitoring and assuring compliance with the requirements for those facilities. So 40 CFR Part 70 are the rules under which EPA allowed us to promulgate our program under their supervision and guidance. The implementing statute that Connecticut drafted in order to write the rules is Connecticut General Statute Section 22A-174C. In this presentation, these are hyperlinked, so you can actually read the text of the regulation. But specifically, what 22A-174C says is that the department has the authority to draft permits and enforce permits for a specific set of applicable requirements that are specified under Part 70, okay? Following that statutory authority, we have a regulation. That regulation provides the nuts and bolts of our Title V program. It gives us a set of definitions that we operate under. It specifies who is subject to the program and when they need to apply. It specifies what needs to be in the application. It specifies what needs to be in the permit. The permits are required to be renewed every 5 years. The permits require that the subject facility certify annually to compliance with those requirements. It requires a number of other submissions from the facility. So that's the nuts and bolts that really governs the program. In addition to these regulatory enabling documents, there are multiple pages of EPA guidance on how to structure and what to put, in the Title V operating permit and technical support document. Oftentimes in our field, you will hear about Sites memos. These memos were written by John Sites, who was an EPA official in the late 90s. These documents are voluminous, and there are three of them that are specific to the structure and content of a Title V permit. So when we write the Title V permits, we have to comply with all of these rules and this guidance. So who needs a Title V operating permit? Any and all Title V sources, as defined by the regulation, are subject to the requirement to apply for and obtain a Title V operating permit. The definition of a Title V source is set forth in the regulatory section you see there, and it is based on three things: the potential emissions from the facility, the applicability of certain federal regulatory programs, and the location of the facility within a state, whether that location is a non-attainment area and the degree to which that location is a non-attainment area. So, for your benefit, the state of Connecticut is in attainment for all of the criteria air pollutants that EPA requires us to monitor and control, except for ozone. And we have technically two non-attainment areas for ozone. One area is called our severe non-attainment ozone area. And for that area is subject to the most stringent requirements applicable to the control of pollutants that can result in ozone. And those pollutants are VOCs, volatile organic compounds, and nitrogen oxides, or NOx, as we call it. Okay. The other area is the serious non-attainment area. That area is subject to stringent rules for NOx and VOC, but they're not as stringent and they don't trigger as at the same emission points as the severe non-attainment area. Currently, under our rules, the severe non-attainment area is pretty much Fairfield County and a couple of other towns. The serious non-attainment area is the rest of the state. Recently, in November of 2022, EPA reclassified certain portions of the state of Connecticut to severe ozone non-attainment, so that now, going forward, the severe non-attainment area will include not only Fairfield County, but also New Haven County and Middlesex County. Okay? Now, with respect to the two Buckeye facilities that are of concern, they are Title V sources, one, because they have the potential to emit greater than 50 tons of volatile organic compounds per year in what is currently, well, which in what was a serious non-attainment area, but is now a severe non-attainment area. If New Haven had been a severe non-attainment area in the past, the trigger point would have been 25 tons instead of 50. And these facilities would still have required Title V permits. So they require Title V permits now, and they will require Title V permits in the future. Okay. And they've had Title V permits that have been renewed every 5 years since the issuance of the first permits in or around the early 2000s. Additionally, the facilities are subject to federal rules under 40 CFR 60 and 40 CFR 63. These are federal rules that govern the emissions of volatile organic compounds from petroleum storage tanks and the emissions of hazardous air pollutants from storage tanks. What goes into a Title V permit? Like I said earlier, Title V permit is a compilation of all of the applicable rules to which a facility is subject, whether those be in permits, regulations, statutes, or enforcement orders, into a single comprehensive document for the purposes of being able to make sure that that facility is complying with those requirements. Those requirements apply in and of themselves, regardless of the fact that the facility has a permit. The permit is simply to consolidate all of those into a single place for the purposes of assuring compliance. What goes into the Title V permit is dictated by the regulations and statutes that I specified earlier, and specifically in this RCA section 22A 174.33J1. And again, that requires that the permit has an expiration date of no later than 5 years from issuance. It requires that they submit an application for renewal of that permit at least 1 year prior to its expiration to give the department the time it needs to review the application and make sure that what we put in the next permit is all that is supposed to be there. The permit also contains all the terms and conditions that will remain in effect until the next permit is issued or denied. It has an explicit requirement that the permittee operate in compliance with the permit terms and conditions. These permit terms and conditions are derived from what are called applicable requirements. And these applicable requirements have a specific definition in that regulation. So there are requirements that some of these facilities are subject to that are either federal only requirements or they're requirements under a program other than Title V. For the purposes of drafting a Title V permit, those are not applicable requirements and do not go into the Title V permit. Only the explicit applicable requirements that apply that are as defined in the regulation go into the Title V permit and can be enforced under the Title V permit. Title V permit also requires requirements to monitor operating parameters, things like material throughput. For certain devices, it will require monitoring temperatures or flows or the types of materials that you put through the process. It requires the permittee to monitor, you know, how much of those, what they are, and in some instances, directly monitor the emissions coming from the specific sources in the permit in order to demonstrate compliance with the applicable requirements of the permit. It also has, the Title V permit also has requirements to submit a number of different types of reports to the department on varying bases. For instance, there is a requirement to submit progress reports if there is a known non-compliance issue that the department has identified and the facility is working to come into compliance with. It requires them to submit a progress report at least every 6 months as to their progress with remedying that non-compliance. It requires annual compliance certifications, which means a responsible party for the permittee has to certify under penalty of law to whether or not the facility has complied with each individual term and condition in the permit. The permit also requires deviation reporting, which means if you deviate from a term or condition in the permit, depending upon the nature and extent of that and the pollutants involved, you have a certain amount of time from the discovery of that deviation to notify the department of that deviation, what caused it, and what you did to fix it. There are requirements for semi-annual monitoring reports, which means all of the monitoring systems that are specified in your permit, procedures that are specified in your permit, you need to semi-annually report to the department on the operations and maintenance of those monitoring systems. If those monitoring systems fail, you have to report that, and you have to report how long that system was failing for and what you did to correct the problem. Once again, those have to be certified under penalty of law by a responsible corporate official. In addition to those, like I said, there's that annual compliance certification. So you have deviation reports, semi-annual monitoring reports, and annual compliance certifications. All of these need to be submitted. In addition, the permit also requires a submission of your annual emissions. So for each piece of equipment and activity at the facility, you need to report on the specific emissions from that to the department. That serves two purposes. Purpose number one is that if you have any emissions limits in your permit, that report helps to demonstrate compliance or verify compliance with those limits, number one. Number two, the program is self-funded by a fee paid by each permittee, and that fee is based on the tons of total pollutant emitted from the facility. So I've covered all that. So what happens when a Title V permit is issued? The permittee is required to comply with the permit. The department performs periodic inspections at the facility, focused on assuring compliance with the terms and conditions of the permit. The department reviews the deviation notifications, and all the other submissions that are required of the permittee. If the permit requires emissions testing, the department may have audit those tests, so that we may be on site for those tests. It is discretionary and is based on resource constraints as to how many emissions tests we actually observe, but we always have the ability to observe those tests. But not only do we have that ability to audit them, but we must review those emissions test results and determine whether or not the facility is in compliance with the emission limits to which the tests are required. If the permit requires continuous emissions monitoring, that is direct emissions from the stack of the source, then the department may audit the quality assurance and quality control procedures that go into validating that information. Additionally, the department will receive all of the records that are gathered by that continuous emissions monitoring system on a quarterly basis. We receive these electronically, or we receive these on compact discs, and we review those to assess compliance with the limits for which that monitoring is in place. If we discover a violation, then we act in accordance with our enforcement response policy. Similarly, when the permittee submits their annual compliance certifications and their annual emissions report, department staff goes through each one of those reports, and we draft a review report that basically goes through and indicates our findings with respect to our review and makes recommendations if we find any noncompliance as to whether or not to initiate an enforcement action in accordance with our enforcement response policy. So how does the public get to participate in this Title V operating permit process? The first opportunity to participate is when just prior to subject source submitting an application. The law requires that prior to the submission of that application, that applicant has to post a notice in the newspaper of general circulation in that area. So generally speaking, that'd be New Haven Register. So each time we get one of these applications, that applicant has to have submitted that notice and had it published in the newspaper. Once we've reviewed the application and come to a tentative determination to either approve or deny the permit application, the department publishes a notice of tentative determination. What that does is initiates a 30-day comment period in which the public has the opportunity to obtain all the documents relevant to the issuance of that determination, review them, submit written comments, and if desired, submit a request for a public hearing. It only takes one person to request a public hearing, and the department is obligated to, at a minimum, provide a public informational hearing in response to that request. The other way that the general public can gain access to the documents that I talked about earlier is through the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. And on this slide, this is actually a link to our FOIA page. And you go to that page and you can request any document or report or submission or data that has been collected and is in the possession of the department. Okay. So I'm going to take a brief moment and stop and entertain any questions about that administrative part of the Title V operating permit program and as to what we do. And just to give you a quick understanding of what happens when an application comes in and what the staff is required to do. So the applications come in and we've provided access to copies of the application for the two Buckeye facilities. These are very long applications. They're on the order of hundreds of pages. The staff receives the application, first makes a determination as to whether or not the application is complete and sufficient for further processing. If it is not, staff will issue a notice of insufficiency and require that the applicant cure whatever deficiencies are in that application. Once the application is complete, staff performs a technical review of the permit application and the prior permit. They do a line-by-line redraft of the permit, going through and making sure that if there have been any changes to applicable law, that those are captured in the new permit. They go through and they also make a determination as to whether or not there is new equipment specified in that application that wasn't previously brought to the department's attention. And they look to see if that equipment should have obtained a permit under any of our other permitting programs. And if that equipment should have, we make a referral to our enforcement colleagues to pursue the issuance of a notice of violation and to require that that individual submits the application that should have been submitted for that piece of equipment. In addition to that, if it rises to that occasion, our enforcement folks may initiate an enforcement action, whether that be an order or a referral to the Attorney General's office to obtain civil penalties and corrective action for having constructed something that doesn't have the required permit and may not meet applicable requirements that would be in that permit. The other thing that the staff does is line by line, prior permit, current application, the pieces of equipment that are listed in that application, they draft the new permit. The new permit will have all the conditions to which the equipment is subject. We'll have clear regulatory citations as to where that applicable requirement came from, the monitoring, record keeping, and reporting necessary to demonstrate compliance with that permit. So the permits are renewed every 5 years. It's not the case necessarily that the same permit engineer will get the renewal for the prior permit. So each time, it is a comprehensive review of the application as opposed to a rubber stamp or an "I'm so familiar with the facility, I don't need to read all of this." Once that draft permit is written, a technical support document, which provides the basis for why the conditions that are listed in that permit are listed in that permit, is also drafted. The draft permit, the technical support document, and the application is then reviewed by the supervisor, then by me. Once we have assurance that we all believe that the permit has the necessary terms and conditions in it, we issue that notice of tentative determination to approve the permit. Those go out under my signature. That initiates that 30-day comment period. At the close of that 30-day comment period, we incorporate whatever comments we receive either from the public or from the applicant or from US EPA. Now, US EPA has a 45-day comment period. It runs concurrently with the 30-day period. So effectively, when the public comment period closes, EPA still has 15 more days to comment. So we don't draft our response to comment document until their 15 days is up. Once their 15 days is up, if they haven't commented, then we put together a comprehensive response to comment document where we basically address each comment. If we get a number of comments that are the same, then we'll obviously consolidate those and we'll say, you know, we got 15, please change the color from red to yellow comments. So we'll, you know, literally in that response to comment documents, we got 15 of these, here's our response. We agree, we're changing it from red to yellow, okay? The comment response document is that specific as to whether or not we're going to take the comment or we are not, because the comment does not apply or the regulatory requirements are clear and we cannot change the permit in response to the comment. That comment response document, finalized draft of the permit, the original technical support document will then be reviewed by the supervisor, by myself, by the bureau chief before the renewal is finally issued. So I've spoken to the process. Does anyone have any questions about the process of issuing a Title V permit?
Yes. So before we go on, several people joined us since you started. I will just tell you who they are. Catherine Lamar, she's the Deputy Corporation Counsel for the City of New Haven. Doreen Abubakar, she is a member of the Environmental Advisory Council. Lynn Bonnet, an interested resident. And Sochi Garcia, who is another member of the Environmental Advisory Council. Sorry. And I know we're making you talk so much, we're giving you a frog in your throat. So, one question was asked about by Steve Winter, our climate and sustainability director. He asked how many emissions audits has Deep performed on Buckeye's New Haven facilities, and I would like to know how often they're performed. I know you said there's a semi-annual report and an annual report, and someone else asked the air quality monitoring, is it based on 24-hour averages, 8-hour averages, acute time releases, or something else?
And then I have a comment later.
Right.
That's Nancy Alderman.
I know. And Chris Ozick had a bunch of comments, a bunch of questions and some comments. He's asking specifically about emissions from the Buckeye sites. And so I'm wondering, I know we discussed the fact that Buckeye has just bought some other facilities that were owned by Wyatt. I'm wondering, do the new permits for their facilities have to include those new facilities in addition to the ones they already have, or is that separate? And anyway, so there was a question about air quality monitoring averages and the question about about audit emissions audits, and just wondering about the renewal, what they cover.
Okay, so I see a number of questions in the chat, and I'll try to address what I see in the chat, but I want to address the first two questions you posed. As to how often are they inspected, I will defer to Jake Felton on the frequency for the Buckeye facilities. Title V facilities have to be inspected at least once during each renewal, and under what I believe we call our compliance monitoring strategy, some are inspected more frequently than that, but that is outside of my area of jurisdiction. That is Jake's area of jurisdiction.
For the Title V terminal, so Waterfront and Forbes Street, they're subject to an on-site full compliance evaluation every two federal fiscal years. An on-site full compliance evaluation means that it's a boots on the ground inspection and that we are verifying compliance with every applicable requirement, which Jameson talked about what an applicable requirement is. But we're verifying compliance with every applicable requirement in the Title V permit. Realistically, we're doing compliance audits of these sources much more than once every other federal fiscal year, every time, you know, one of the Title V, the annual compliance certifications, for example, every time one of those is submitted, we'll review it. And, you know, as Jameson mentioned, we'll write our own review of the source's Title V annual compliance certification. Anytime that there's emission testing of the facility, we try our hardest to actually do an on-site audit of that test as resources allow, and then we will always review the test report and review the results in detail. So, I mean, it's biannual on-site full compliance evaluation with many more types of compliance evaluations in the intervening year.
Thank you.
Okay. Unfortunately, I forgot what your second question was.
Is the air quality monitoring based on 24-hour averages, 8-hour averages, acute real-time releases, or something else?
Okay, that's a complicated question, and I'm going to do my best, and then I'm going to defer to Paul. So when it comes to emissions monitoring that I specify, or my staff specifies in a permit, we are talking about a monitor that is literally sitting inside the stack of a piece of equipment. And that monitor is monitoring based on a specific emissions limit or concentration. Concentrations are usually, again, what's in the exhaust coming out of that stack at that point in time. And we are correlating that to a specific limitation that is usually parts per million by volume. It may be dry, it may be wet, and it may be based on a certain diluent gas. But that is an actual in-stack measurement. It is very different than ambient air quality monitoring, okay? When we are looking at those numbers, we are comparing those numbers to a specific number in the permit. whereas ambient air quality modeling is looking more so at the concentration of pollutants in the outside air, and they're looking at it in comparison to a national ambient air quality standard. These are concentration-based standards, and they have differing time periods associated with them. For example, there is a one-hour NO2 standard. There is also, I believe, an eight-hour NOx standard. PM is monitored on a different time scale, particulate matter, that is. There is no ambient monitoring that I'm aware of specifically for volatile organic compounds, which are the emissions that come from these facilities, because there's no ambient air quality standard for volatile organic compounds. And before I put my foot in my mouth, I'm going to defer to Paul.
Thanks, Jameson. You did excellent. So you were spot on. So just again, a little level setting here. So, you know, we're talking about Title V. That's Title V of the 1990 Clean Air Act Amendments. There's a bunch of titles before that, four, if my math serves. So Title I of the Clean Air Act has to do with these national ambient air quality standards for six criteria pollutants. And Connecticut operates 14 air monitoring stations throughout the state to get a sense as to the regional impact of air pollution for these six pollutants. You know, they're carbon dioxide, lead, NOx, nitrogen oxides, sulfur dioxides, ozone, which is really the one that is of most concern for Connecticut. The equipment, for the most part, is sensitive enough to get minute data down to, you know, parts per billion. What we report out is, again, going to depend on the form of the standard that EPA has imposed on us. And so, you know, those national ambient air quality standards are health-based standards, and they're based on rigorous scientific review by EPA before they're developed and issued through, you know, federal notice and comment rulemaking. And it takes a long time to cycle through until it gets to our level at the state where we're actually implementing and monitoring and providing feedback to EPA with respect to our compliance with those standards.
Now, I did notice on the New Haven, oh, I don't know if it was the Environmental Advisory Council page or New Haven Environmental Health page, but there's a link to Air Now. We also have a link to Air Now. That is the EPA system that accepts ambient monitoring data and presents it so that you can tell, for instance, on a high ozone day, whether it's the ozone is too bad to go outside, or whether the particulate emissions concentration outside in the ambient air is too high. Correct me if I'm wrong there, Paul, on what Air Now does.
Yeah, it does both. It uses real-time data to tell you what the air is like, and there's also a forecasting component that looks to tomorrow and the next day to see, you know, what we're predicting the air quality will be like based on what we know about the characteristic of the emissions in the atmosphere and the weather.
Okay. Thank you. I just put a link in the chat. Is it okay if Nancy Alderman asks a question now?
Sure.
Thank you.
Myself. Okay, am I unmuted? Am I okay? Hello? Am yes. I okay? Can you hear me?
Yes, good to go.
Okay. I first want to say that Jameson Sinclair gave a really incredible overview of what the DEP is required to do. And I am extremely sympathetic to all of the provisions that DEP has to comply with. However, you know, I have worked long enough in environmental issues to know that even when a permit is completely adhered to, and I did notice that this permit relies heavily on the applicant himself or herself or themselves to submit the data. I understand that you review it, but still, they are heavily, heavily responsible for giving you or giving DEP the data. And when we're all done with this, I mean, I could ask a million questions, but actually when we're all done and everything has been adhered to, we are still left in New Haven with all of these gas receptacles or whatever that emit enough odor all the time or at certain times that one has to know what is happening. Why are the odors so extreme? Why do they affect whole neighborhoods? And even though I've listened to this whole presentation, which has been very impressive, I don't understand what is actually going on that we are left with terrible odors coming from Buckeye that are not explained. And if the permit was good enough for Buckeye to prevent what we are all experiencing, then we wouldn't be experiencing it in the first place. So I guess my question is, what is missing? What is missing? I know you're all doing your job, and I know that the federal government expects a huge amount from you, and you are doing a really good job adhering to everything they are asking you. But we're still left with serious effluence that we really need to address. And so I guess my question to you, is the permit not good enough? Are the people not giving you accurate data? What is causing the problems that caused us, or at least Chris Ozek, to ask what is going on? Why is it going on? How is it going on? And what should the public do about it to get it better? And so those are my questions.
Okay. So let me start with, so there will be a more detailed discussion of the two facilities in a very short period of time following this conversation and me answering your questions. I do have some slides specifically on the facilities, but I wanted to give everyone the opportunity to understand what goes into a Title V permit and how the program applies. But the other thing is, to be clear, a Title V permit and even an NSR permit is not designed to result in no emissions. It is designed to mitigate the emissions to the point where they comply with applicable law. And so you will still have some emissions that come from the facility, even with with a permit where the facility does their due diligence and is the best neighbor possible, there will still be some emissions, number one. Number two, my understanding is you have a public health background. Is that correct?
Yes, I run a group of physicians and public health professionals, and that's what we do.
Okay, excellent. So with respect to odors, now, first let me preface this by saying, not only have I worked as a permit engineer for the beginning of my career, but I also spent 12 years in our enforcement program. So I will say this, there are a number of compounds that have an odor threshold that is lower or more easily detected or is a lower concentration than the amount of the substance that is necessary to cause an acute health impact. And so from that standpoint, you will smell it before it is at a concentration for which you will have a toxicological response. Okay? However, and this has been demonstrated throughout the 12 years that I was in enforcement, many times the cases that we were working on, I was a supervisor in enforcement as well as a staff person in enforcement. Many times the cases that we were working on had to do with odors, and odors have the ability, and I'm not saying that this is the case. All I'm saying is that this is true in general about odors, that odors have the ability to trigger physiological reactions. And those physiological reactions can be quite severe, but are not actual toxicological responses to a concentration that is above a health threshold. Okay? Jake, has anything that I just said been contrary to your experience or been incorrect?
No, I agree with everything you said.
Okay. Now, so you there will be instances where there will be an odor. There will be instances where there will be an odor and there will not be an acute toxicological issue, but you will have physiological symptoms because that odor, you are sensitized to that odor. There will also be cases when there is an odor and there is a toxicological effect. Okay? So I don't want to be blind to it, but I just want to be clear that there can be an odor without a toxicological effect. I don't know exactly what the situation is in that area because I haven't experienced the odors. But what I will say is that regardless of whether there is a toxicological effect, we have odor nuisance laws on our books, in which case no one can cause or contribute to an odor that causes a nuisance. And if the public feels aggrieved by the observation of an odor, we maintain a complaint line with our enforcement division, which enables someone to make a complaint. And given our resources, we will at some point perform an investigation with respect to that complaint in order to determine if the odors rise to the regulatory nuisance level. And if they do, we take appropriate enforcement action, depending on the nature of the compound and how bad the nuisance is. Jake, can you elaborate a little further on that odor piece?
Sure. Yeah, it's everything you said. We have a regulatory nuisance standard that applies to odor. And if you know, we conduct an investigation and we determine that an odor nuisance has occurred, we could take enforcement action. And that's certainly been done in the past. Our response to odor complaints is based on resources. It's not like a next day response or anything like that. But you can certainly, you know, call in or email in complaints whenever you're experiencing the perceived odor nuisance. I just don't want to set an unreal expectation as to, you know, when we would be able to respond to the complaint, because it's not a same day, same week type of deal. I would also encourage you to work with, you know, the municipality. A lot of these odor nuisances, whether it's like a dust nuisance, odor nuisance, a lot of these nuisance issues are also at heart, you know, urban planning issues where we don't have regulatory jurisdiction. So I'm not at all suggesting not to, you know, file a complaint with us. You should, but you know, I think it's also probably productive to work with the municipality, which has the, you know, urban planning authority.
Okay. Now, to go to another one of your concerns, Nancy, many people are specifying that it's Buckeye. I do want to point out that in close proximity to the two Buckeye facilities are a number of other tank farm facilities, including New Haven Terminal, which is also a Title V source, Gulf, which is also a Title V source, Global. I'm not sure if Global is a Title V source. I have to check our list. But in that area, there are several tank farms. Additionally, there are tank farms in that area that are not subject to our programs under Title V because the materials they store in the tank don't result in potential emissions above that 50-ton trigger threshold, and are not subject to any federal applicable requirements. And they could be storing things like asphaltic cement, also called AC-20 or Bunker C, or even residual oil, basically the crude oil that gets burned in New Haven Harbor Station's power plant. That type of petroleum product has a very acrid smell. And in the scientific literature, there are numerous reports of the smell of that material also causing people's faces to itch, inflaming nasal tissue, being an eye irritant. There are a lot of terminals in that area. And I will, so when we finish talking about Buckeye, I will give you a little bit of insight into some regulatory development that the department is working on specifically with respect to terminals that would be able to, that may be able to, if promulgated, assist with some of the problems in terms of odors and emissions from that source category globally, not just the Buckeye facilities. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been very helpful. Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to jump to the questions in the chat and see. All right. So there's two questions in here. What products are handled at 280 Waterfront Street and what emissions and how much come from this site? I will take care of that in the summary of those two sites, which is coming up next. What is an attainment area and is this neighborhood one? Yes, all of New Haven is currently now a severe non-attainment area for ozone. And what that means is that the ozone concentration during the summertime in those areas does not meet the national ambient air quality standards. And the way that is determined is based on the ambient monitors in that area, which monitor the ambient concentration and compare that to the standard. Okay. How are the emissions from this site tracked? I'll cover that in the summary of those two facilities. What is the impact on human health and climate? I will cover that as well in the summary of those two facilities. Okay, so another question in the chat is, air quality data center was moved from Criscola Park on the water. Sample air is not reflective of the port as it does not test for volatile organic compounds. Where are these samples for VOC and SOX taken to provide data to EPA, or are they just estimates based on permits? So I want to defer to Paul on ambient air quality monitoring and whether or not ambient air quality monitoring monitors for VOC emissions. Paul, can you explain that quickly?
Sure. The short answer is we do not monitor for VOC at Criscola Park. We monitor for ozone, which is a secondary pollutant, which is formed when VOCs and NOx react in warmer temperatures to form ozone.
All right. How many emissions audits has Deep performed at Buckeye? Jake just indicated that we do once every 2 years. The most recent inspections were in 2021 and I believe 2020 for those two facilities. And the copies of the inspection reports associated with those inspections have been provided in that link that was given to Laura Kahn. And I will work with Laura to help her download those, and she will be able to distribute those. Or as she indicated at the beginning of the meeting, she will forward the email addresses for anyone interested in that information. And my supervisor that made that information available will make it available to those interested parties as well. So is it the case that Buckeye does not currently have continuous emissions monitoring? I will cover that. Is the air quality based on 24-hour averages? We did cover that. This question. Does Deep aggregate total emissions? We will cover that in the summary. Is there also a permit for an overall permit for New Haven Port Authority? No, there is not. The Port Authority, to my knowledge, is not a Title V source. Does the city do any monitoring? I cannot answer that
question. Excuse me. It's Sally from the Port Authority. The Port Authority does not operate any emission sources at all.
Thank you, Sally.
You're welcome.
There's a question here that says, does the city do any monitoring to supplement Deep's work? I can't answer that question.
Okay, I would love to hear about Buckeye specifically, if you're ready to do that. I'm sorry to make you keep talking, Jameson.
Absolutely. So here are the Buckeye facilities, 134 Forbes Street. So this facility predates the Clean Air Act and the department. The oldest tank constructed was in or around 1949. According to Deep's records, this facility, the first records that Deep has come from 1973. It was owned by Mobil Corp. Most recent prior owner was Magellan Midstream Partners. The business is petroleum product storage and distribution. And the equipment on site is basically a set of large petroleum storage tanks and loading racks to dispense those products in that tank to tanker trucks for wholesale or onto marine vessels. The facility also has the capability to receive both gasoline and non-gasoline products from marine vessels. The waterfront facility is pretty much the exact same type of facility. However, it's older. It was previously owned by ARCO. Again, it was acquired by Magellan Midstream Partners at some point and was purchased from Magellan Midstream Partners at the same time by Buckeye when Buckeye acquired Forbes Street. Again, set of large storage tanks with loading racks and marine vessel offloading and loading capabilities. The majority of the tanks are registered. What that means is they predate our individual equipment-specific permit program. So the only thing that limits the emissions and operations of those tanks is the design of the tanks. Okay, because they predate our regulations. The loading racks have permits. There's one loading rack for gasoline products. There's a loading rack for distillate products. Gasoline is a significantly more volatile liquid than distillate oil. When I say distillate oil, I mean home heating fuel, kerosene, jet fuel, diesel fuel and other distillate products. Gasoline, on the other hand, is a, like I said, a much more volatile compound. The facilities, both facilities, can store any of those materials that I just mentioned. For the loading racks, because the loading racks distribute gasoline, they have, one, based on their date of construction, and two, their potential emissions, because gasoline is so volatile, they have equipment-specific permits. They were constructed after our equipment-specific air permitting program went into effect, and they have emissions that trigger that program. Therefore, they have specific permits for the gasoline loading racks at both facilities. Those permits specify the amount of gasoline that can be moved through that loading rack and loaded into tanker trucks. Those permits also specify that when gasoline is being transferred into the storage tanks of those trucks, that a vapor recovery system or vapor combustion system must be in operation to reduce the emissions of gasoline VOCs during that transfer. So if you will, you are putting gasoline into the truck through a hose. That hose is coaxial, which basically is a hose inside a hose. One part of that hose is delivering liquid into the truck. The other part of that hose is vacuuming out the vapor that's in the truck and taking that to an emissions control device where it is either being burned or recovered by means of carbon absorption. I don't have a permit in front of me right now, so I can't tell you which one they have, whether they're vapor combustion units or vapor recovery units, which is the carbon absorption. But either way, the design of that piece of equipment is such that the gasoline vapors that are emitted to the atmosphere are controlled to a specific numeric level. That control equipment needs to be in operation anytime that you are transferring gasoline through that loading rack into a tanker truck. In addition to that, the tanker trucks that come and receive gasoline have to be vapor tight in accordance with Connecticut law. They need to have a certificate that specifies that they've been vapor tested and are vapor tight in accordance with law. If that truck comes to the loading rack and it does not have its documentation, or it has not passed its documentation, Buckeye is required to send that truck away and not load gas into it. Now, the vapor recovery systems on the loading racks are essentially the only separate operating control equipment at the facility. The design of the tanks themselves in which the gasoline is stored is mandated by law, and that mandate is designed to mitigate the emissions from filling and emptying the tanks. What that law requires is that the tank has a fixed dome over it. So you can see that fixed dome from the outside when you're looking at the tanks. Underneath that dome is what is called a floating roof. That floating roof is a membrane with seals all around it so that it snugs up to the sides of the tank, and it sits on top of the liquid surface and it moves up and down with the liquid surface inside the tank. The primary purpose of that is to prevent or to minimize the evaporation of the gasoline inside that tank. It is required by law. It is contained in the Title V permits. That requirement is written into the Title V permits for both facilities. Again, it is designed to minimize the emissions, but not prevent those emissions. all these facilities do, these two facilities, is receive, store, and distribute petroleum products. Now, the maintenance of those tanks from time to time requires that the tank be drained, that the roof is landed at its highest point, and that you open the tank and let air flow through to reduce the concentration of vapors in the tank to a level at which humans can enter the tank and perform maintenance activities on the tank. When that happens on a pound per hour basis, that is one of the highest VOC emitting activities that those tanks experience. It does not happen frequently, but when it does, it is a high emitting event. Now, there are multiple tanks at that facility, so that provides an opportunity for multiple high emitting events. But again, they're not frequent. They typically have to do with changing over product in the tank from one product, for instance, distillate oil, to gasoline, or vice versa, or when changing from winter gasoline stock to summer gasoline stock. In the state of Connecticut, we are subject to reformulated gasoline rules. And in the summertime, the gasoline that we use is required to be less volatile than the gasoline that we would use outside of the summertime. The principal reason why you would use higher volatility gasoline in the winter is because its volatility is required to start an internal combustion engine like a car or a generator in the wintertime. You can't use summer gas in the winter. It'll either freeze or it won't start the vehicle. So that's why we have two grades of gasoline. The summertime gasoline is required to be less volatile in order to help us achieve compliance with our ozone problems. The less volatile it is, the less able it is to contribute to ozone emissions. So on those loading racks that dispense gasoline at both facilities is a continuous emissions monitor. Its purpose is to demonstrate compliance and assure that the emissions of gasoline coming from the loading rack when the loading rack is filling trucks doesn't exceed a specific numerical limit. I believe the numerical limit in the current Buckeye permits is 10 milligrams per liter of gasoline dispensed. So there's a monitor that is sitting there and reading mass of volatile organic compounds. There is also a meter that is measuring the quantity of gasoline being dispensed. And they are required to calculate and record the emissions based on that monitor and that meter of gasoline being dispensed in order to assure that that monitor is reading properly. They are also required to perform an emissions test periodically, where they actually test the emissions from that vapor recovery device when gasoline is being distributed to a truck, and they get an independent of that monitor reading. And that reading is compared to what the monitor is doing to make sure that the monitor is correct and also to demonstrate compliance with the numerical limit. That is a federal requirement. That is a requirement of the permits for those loading racks. It is also contained in the Title V permit, and they have to certify the compliance for it. They have to submit the stack test results to the department. They have to provide us an opportunity to witness that stack test. All of these records can be obtained through the FOIA process, which I've provided a link on one of the prior slides for. So there have been questions about recent enforcement actions at those two facilities. Under Buckeye's ownership and management of the facilities, the department has only issued one notice of violation to date. That notice of violation was issued to the Waterfront Street property. It was issued for a tank that was constructed in 2008 prior to Buckeye's obtaining ownership of the facility. It was a tank that was put in by Magellan. That tank was put in when information that they provided and that they relied upon indicated that the tank did not emit enough VOCs to trigger our equipment-specific permitting program. They were, in fact, incorrect. That was not discovered until recently. The notice of violation, unfortunately, went to Buckeye, and Buckeye went through the process of obtaining the necessary permit for that tank. Because that permit was treated as if it had been constructed today rather than in 2008, it is subject to some of the most stringent requirements in Connecticut with respect to a gasoline storage tank. Specifically, those high emitting events that I discussed earlier, where the tank has to be popped open and let to vent so that people can go into the tank and perform maintenance activities. This tank is not allowed to do that. When they need to, that's called degassing. When they need to degas this tank, they are required to connect it to a vapor control device to reduce the emissions from that degassing event. It is the only tank in Connecticut at the moment that has a permit requiring such. There are a few tanks that have permits pending that will have similar requirements in them at another facility. So there have been questions about the annual emissions from the facility. The primary emissions from this type of activity are volatile organic compounds. Within those volatile organic compounds, there are certain hazardous air pollutants. When we talk about gasoline, the hazardous air pollutants that we are primarily concerned with are benzene, toluene, ethylene, and xylene. Xylene. I spelled that wrong on the slide. I apologize. It's XY, not ZY. But these are commonly called BTECs. And they're a component of gasoline. Gasoline is a mixture of a variety of flammable materials that is used to power a vehicle. And that mixture contains these chemicals here. That's what makes it volatile. Okay. All of those are federal hazardous air pollutants. Now, the interesting thing with respect to this facility is the trigger threshold for hazardous air pollutants is 25 tons of aggregate hazardous air pollutants. This facility, however, does not actually emit 25 tons of hazardous air pollutants. Based on the emissions calculation methodologies that I'm going to discuss shortly. And for that reason, has requested that we put a limit in the permit to limit them to less than 25 tons, make them demonstrate compliance with that limit. Okay. I'll discuss that more in a second. So the primary emissions are VOCs. VOCs are ozone precursors. In the presence of sunlight and NOx, VOCs combine to form ozone. That's what triggers our ozone non-attainment. These are not greenhouse gases. And so from that standpoint, the facility in and of itself has limited direct climate impact. However, they sell gasoline and other fossil fuels. So downstream of the facility, there is obviously a climate impact with respect to the use of the product that the facility sells. They are not directly responsible for those downstream emissions under our current regulatory structure. So we don't have any rules in place from a greenhouse gas standpoint that would apply to this facility. So what do their annual emissions look like? Here's a table of the annual emissions from these facilities over the past 5 years. Now, note in 17, 18, and part of 19, I believe these facilities were owned by Magellan as opposed to Buckeye. So for the Forbes Street facility, remember how I was saying prior to November of 2022, New Haven was a serious ozone non-attainment area. And the trigger point for being a major stationary source at that time was 50 tons. Forbes Street's actual emissions, as reported to the department, didn't reach the 50 ton mark. So they were actually emitting less than the major source trigger. That's not the case for Waterfront. As you can see, they've been above the 50-ton mark more than once. So how are these emissions tracked and monitored? For the storage tanks, we look at annual material throughput. So that looks at the volume of material that has been received and removed from the tank. What that material is, it takes into account the chemical and physical properties of that material. And there is a set of calculations based on the best science and EPA methods for calculating the emissions from those storage tanks. Those EPA methods also have specific methods for those high emitting events, those maintenance events that I talked about, where you have to pop the tank open and air it out. And when they report their emissions at the end of the year, it's the sum of emissions from simply filling the tank and emptying the tank through the natural course of distributing product and selling it away, plus the emissions from any high-emitting maintenance activities. So if they degas the tank, they have to include that in the emissions. If they have to do what's called a roof landing, which is a high emitting event, they also have to include that in their emissions. It's the sum of those for each tank at the facility. Okay. For the loading racks and for the marine vessel loading, specifically the loading racks, it's the annual material throughput, so that's typically gas and distillate oil. the volume of that material that has gone through the tank, that's usually in millions of gallons or hundreds of thousands of gallons. With respect to the gasoline, there is that actual VOC monitor on the vapor combustion system that's actually monitoring the mass of emissions. And for the distillate distribution through that loading rack, since that monitor is not in play, there are specific calculations based on the best science and EPA methods that are used to calculate the emissions from those distillate loading operations. Once again, for each individual tank, you have to make this calculation. You have to make this calculation according to the Title V permit on a monthly basis, and then roll that up to an annual aggregate. And you report that to the department. Same for the loading racks. You have to calculate its emissions on a monthly basis, record them, roll that up, and then report that to the department on an annual basis.
Wow, that was pretty amazing. Thank you so much, Jameson, for translating such technical information so that some of us could begin to understand it. Thank you to you and Jake and Paul and Lou and everybody at DEEP who helped us try to get our hands around this. So I'm wondering if we could work on changing the law to require that every tank comply with the newest, most stringent requirements. Is that something that one can work towards? Should we consult our state legislators?
So I will give you a quick explanation of the regulatory prompt, the reg development process in Connecticut. There is a very big difference between how we go about promulgating regulations in Connecticut versus Massachusetts and New York. And that big difference is the Legislative Regulatory Review Committee. Unlike Massachusetts and New York, every time Connecticut promulgates a reg, and it doesn't matter which agency it is that's seeking to promulgate the reg, first things first, they need to have the statutory authority to draft that regulation. Our statutes are broad. We have broad statutory authority to deal with air pollution in our regulations. However, one, there is a statute that says every time we promulgate a reg that is more stringent than the federal requirements, we have to explain in painstaking detail why we are doing so. So the question that you just asked, not a federal regulatory requirement to do so. So we're going to have to explain in painstaking detail why we are doing that. Then, after we go through the whole stakeholder process and we believe we have the best reg that serves the community, we have to submit that reg to the Legislative Regs Review Committee, which is a bipartisan committee of legislators who review the regulation and make a determination as to whether or not it passes. And that's where things move out of the technical and legal realm into the political realm and are completely outside the control of the department.
Yeah, I understand it's not within the control of the department. I was just wondering if you thought sometimes we ask our state legislatures to do things, and I was thinking maybe we would make this request of them, but.
That is.
Let me jump in for a second.
Go ahead.
So I've been, taking notes, and there's been great dialogue in the chat, and it's really given me personally some food for thought to take back to my team. The question on cumulative impacts, I thought was, it's essential for us to dig into that and see where our pressure points are, where we can learn more about that. There was another one about requiring notification for the high emitting events. I think we need to look at that as well. Some of the other data that I think we need to develop and that we will be developing in the near future is going to be through the deployment of a new monitoring device that we're working on. It's a mobile monitoring platform that will actually monitor for BTEX that Jameson just mentioned there, the benzene, xylene, toluene, all the fun stuff. So that's going to give us a sense as to what the overall impact is in New Haven as we can deploy this vehicle and get geospatial data from the emissions from all of these sources, not just the Buckeye facility. So you guys raise an excellent question about our regulatory authority to require these additional requirements. It's something that I think we need to be assessing as we look at the additional air planning requirements that are going to be imposed on the state of Connecticut by virtue of this, we call it a bump up, the change from the serious non-attainment status to severe non-attainment status. It's going to require a whole new set of plans that Connecticut's going to have to submit to EPA, sort of demonstrate how we're going to meet that standard in a timely fashion. So there's a lot going on here. And, you know, I think the regulatory perspective and approach is definitely one of the things we're going to be looking at.
Absolutely. And to back up what Paul is saying, so recently in the state of Maine, there have been some changes made to their tanks and terminals regulations. We are evaluating those changes to see what we can take away from that. But the reason I mentioned what I mentioned about the Legislative Rights Review Committee is that in terms of promulgating a regulation, we need the support of the community and constituents to lean on legislators and demonstrate the need and the desire for these types of regulations to assist us in getting them across the goal line. And so that's why I said, you know, that part is we have no control, and the control is in the political arena, and we need definitely constituents who are working on our behalf to help us pass those regulations.
Okay, great. So if whoever can stop the screen sharing, if you can do that, that would be amazing. Sure. We will save the questions in the chat so that anybody who wants to see them doesn't have to write frantically, thank you. And we normally end at least by 7. And this has been really amazing for those of us who wanted to learn more about this interesting situation and what's causing the odors. And if anybody has any more questions you didn't think of tonight and you want to convey to Jameson or Paul or Jake, we can do that. Anstris, you have your hand raised. You're muted.
Have you been able to determine yet whether the site on the west side of the river is part, will be included in the total Title V for Buckeye?
So we're still evaluating that. The issue with that is we have a copy of the application. The application has been placed in the documents that Laura will be able to share, or that my staff person will also be able to share. A quick look at the site plan in that application indicates that the Title V permit does not speak to the operations at 85 East Street. Now, 85 East Street was priorly owned by Wyatt Energy. It appears that it is only a distillate facility, and we may need to have conversations with Buckeye to determine whether that facility and I believe it's the Waterfront Street facility, or maybe it's the Fortune facility. There's a facility across the river. The facilities are across the river from each other. We may need to do further investigation as to whether or not they should be consolidated into the Title V permit based on whether or not they are adjacent and contiguous. And there's a specific legal definition for adjacent and contiguous. And we need to continue our investigation on that. And we thank you for raising it in the conversation with the hearing officer about that, because from a permit standpoint, there are no permits or registrations for that 85 East Street facility under its prior owner or any other prior owner. which leads me to believe that it was a distillate-only facility, which generally wouldn't trigger permitting. But if they move material back and forth between that facility and the facility across the harbor, then that may trigger this adjacent and contiguous piece of the definition of Title V source. So we need to do some more research on that.
Thank you. Okay. So I see, yeah, Kathy, well, there's going to be, DEEP is holding a public hearing on March 23rd at 6 p.m. on Zoom. It's a public information hearing for everyone to get information and for questions that were not answered tonight to be answered and for more information to be conveyed. So we can, you can ask about it then. Steve, you have your hand raised.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Jameson and the DEEP team for this detailed presentation. This had come up in the chat, but I wanted to follow up on it because it wasn't addressed, but it was about two of the distillate loading bays don't have any kind of fume control. Right. I wanted to know why that's allowed.
So one, there's no legal requirement for control of the distillate bays. And the reason that there's no legal requirement for that is because distillate is not a very volatile liquid when you're transferring it back and forth. It has a very low vapor pressure. So from that standpoint, it's not subject to high volatile organic compound emissions. However, it may have a low odor threshold. And from that standpoint, may result in a smell that you can smell off-site.
And what are the expectations around responsiveness to nuisance odor complaints? I think I heard that it wouldn't be the same day or even the same week.
So if Jake is still on, that's his area. I hate to throw him under the bus, but...
Sure. It just depends on resources and the gravity of the complaint and the threat to public health and environmental health. So I can't really quote a response time other than to say we triage complaints and respond to them according to that process.
And with the like large emission events and degassing events, what kind of notification might we expect and how would that be received?
So under current law, which is how the Title V permit is drafted, the only time that they are required to notify the department of a degassing event is if that degassing event occurs in the summer. Because generally speaking, they are prohibited from degassing in the summer unless it is absolutely necessary from a safety standpoint.
And are there any requirements or could there be any requirements notifying the public at large?
So there aren't any requirements to notify the public at large. I would say that is something that the department would definitely listen to the public in terms of a request and evaluate that in accordance with all of the other things that Paul and I alluded to that will be happening with respect to these facilities and our response to the bump up.
And a similar question is like with the continuous emissions monitoring equipment, is that information shared in any real time with DEEP? And could that be shared with the public so that there's more assurance that the monitoring equipment of where it's currently required is functioning the way it's supposed to?
So correct me if I'm wrong, Jake, but continuous emissions monitoring data is not shared in real time with the department, correct?
That's correct. It's not pulled. Certain information is submitted quarterly, and that information is public record and is subject to FOIA. It would be information that, you know, would might show the effectiveness or the efficacy of the monitor, of the continuous emission monitor, but it's not necessarily all of the monitoring data over the preceding quarter.
And do we currently, as the department, have the capability to receive that information in real time?
Does the technical capability exist? Probably, but there's no regulatory or statutory requirement to provide the agency with the emission data in real time. So it's kind of similar to other things we've been talking about, where the regulatory or statutory context just doesn't exist.
Correct. And we really don't have the infrastructure right now in the department to actually receive it if it was available on a voluntary basis.
Change that law too.
Let's talk about that one. That's a
yeah. Okay. And stress one more comment and then we're going to wrap it up.
Yeah. I made a short comment in the chat, wondering about the origin of the regulations. Maybe so back in history that we don't know, we won't have an answer tonight. But I think the essence of my question is, how did the regulations evolve if there is a roof of 50 tons? That 50 tons, if it was released in the middle of the Great Plains and not near anyone, would still have a climate impact that would be serious and that you'd have to be concerned about. But it wouldn't be as likely to have a human health impact. Whereas you release that with houses that are a few hundred yards away, it has a completely different impact. So it seems that's one of the things that as DEP evolves and if regulations can be not only for cumulative impact, but how many people are actually living close to the vicinity. Let's say within a quarter mile area, you know, depending on the wind can change direction. There's some very good studies about wind that were done around English Station 20 years ago. And it shows where different kinds of materials are likely to land in New Haven based on their weight and typical wind directions. And a lot of this is obviously hitting Fairhaven most. And actually parts of North Brantford. So that's it. That needs to be worked into it because that's the real life impact.
Completely agree. So, I mean, if you really, Jameson in his slide about the origins of these facilities, some of them have existed for 80 years, you know, since the 20s and 40s before the Clean Air Act. So when Congress initially promulgated the Clean Air Act in the 70s, they had to draw a line in the sand, right? So if you were already existing, you're an existing source and a different set of rules applied to you, if you came into existence after that line in the sand was drawn, then you're a new source and newer, more stringent rules apply to you going forward. And that's sort of, it's been that way ever since. And it's been, I would say, technology-based limits rather than health-based limits for a lot of these sources. We're learning more about that, and we're learning that these exposures over time are much more impactful than Congress or the scientists 50, 60 years ago knew. So it's up to us now to take that data, to internalize it, to look at the structure of the regulatory framework now and how can we adjust that to better reflect what we know about how dangerous these pollutants are today. So I think that's, what Jameson was alluding to about sort of the next phase of our regulatory framework for these sources in the context of the bump up.
Yeah.
Great. Very good summary. Okay. Thank you very, very much, Jameson and Paul and Jacob. We really, really appreciate your being here with us. And we would love a copy of the PowerPoint presentation so we can all refer to it and show how much we learned this evening. And we will see you on March 23rd We will try to pore through all the documents you provided before that. We will provide questions if we have any before that. And I can't thank you enough for spending this evening with us. It was very, very informative.
My pleasure. Happy to do it.
Thank you very much.
Meet everyone.
Okay. Good night, everybody. Thanks. Dawn?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, we went on so long.